Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in our new super-secret location somewhere in the wilds of East County as we've been in the midst of moving this week. Today we open our show with an update on the presidential primary race, including some big wins for two underdog candidates in Wisconsin who are coming up strong, plus a look ahead to New York. Next up from Public News Service, we'll have some more national news and an international scandal, the Panama Papers. Hear how it's affecting world leaders. Other top stories include Bill Clinton's criticism of Black Lives Matter protesters, President Obama speaking out on the Senate's obstruction of his Supreme Court nominee, how climate change impacts could make people sick here on the West Coast, issues of housing discrimination against ex-convicts, and an ACLU lawsuit over confiscation of property from immigrants who are deported. On Jobs Talk, hear about California's new law raising the minimum wage and why two local groups representing Chaldean businesses here in East County are split on the measure with one for and one against. California has a new law making access to birth control easier for women and teens, and we'll have details on today's show. Then we'll be replaying our newsmaker interview with the Reverend Shane Harris from the National Action Network, and he'll be talking about his efforts to get issues such as fair housing and criminal justice reforms on the national radar through his meetings with presidential candidates. He'll also discuss his efforts right here in San Diego to bring about civil rights and social justice reforms. On Tribal Beat, learn how a local Native American tribe has taken steps to help people in need of urgent medical care in East County. And finally, on our sports report, we'll have some good news for San Diego Gulls fans. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with the latest results from the presidential primary trail. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Texas Senator Ted Cruz won big victories in Tuesday's Wisconsin primary, making contested conventions in both the Democratic and Republican parties increasingly possible prospects. In the Democratic primary, Sanders beat former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton by 13 points. Sanders picks up 48 delegates and Clinton 38. Among pledged delegates chosen by voters, Clinton's lead has narrowed to about 250, though she still enjoys a big lead among the superdelegates. But some of those could change their allegiances, which occurred in 2008 when about 100 of them switched from Clinton to Barack Obama. Sanders also has momentum, having won 6 of the last 7 primaries, all by large margins. On the Republican side, Senator Cruz trounced Trump by a 48% to 35% margin. Cruz picks up 36 delegates and Trump just 6. Kasich got 14%, falling short of getting even a single delegate. The odds are looking increasingly strong that neither Trump nor Cruz will have enough delegates to win outright on the first ballot at the convention. On a second ballot, Republican delegates would be freed from their pledges to vote for any candidate they choose. Next up, all eyes are on New York, which is rich in delegate count. If Brooklyn-born Sanders can defeat Clinton in New York, a state she formerly represented in Congress, her viability could be cast into doubt. Though early polls showed her leading by 40 points, 3 new polls show her lead has narrowed to about 10 points in New York. Sanders has enjoyed last-minute surges in several recent states, so with nearly 2 weeks remaining before the April 19th primary, the prospect of him pulling ahead or possibly even surpassing her remains strong. Though Trump has suffered defeats to Cruz in recent primaries, New York is his home state. But a new Reuters poll shows Trump leading Cruz by just 4 points, a statistical dead heat after the poll margin of error is taken into account in New York. A loss on his home turf could leave the business mogul Trump floundering and increase the chances that delegates would shift allegiances on a second ballot. A Trump campaign representative this week issued a threat to reveal names and hotel rooms of any Trump delegates who switched their votes, however, so whether delegates would ignore such bluster or let fear constrain their actions remains to be seen.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, April 8, 2016. I'm Mark Richardson. Today's news goes global as world leaders are beginning to fall as the information from the Panama Papers exposes more financial malfeasance. A campaign rally gets contentious for Bill Clinton as he stumps in New York for Hillary, and a new report says climate change could make many Americans sick. We start out with the international fallout from the release of the Panama Papers, a massive leak of documents from a Panama law firm that helped political leaders, wealthy individuals, and companies hide financial assets and dealings. The latest high-profile victim is British Prime Minister David Cameron, who admits that he profited from his late father's offshore investment. The scandal has already cost Iceland's prime minister his job and has Russia's Vladimir Putin calling the whole thing a U.S.-led plot to weaken Russia. With more than 11 million pages of information leaked, stay tuned for more revelations. President Obama calls Republican senators to task on Thursday for refusing to hold a hearing on his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. The GOP has said it will not consider any candidate put forth by Obama, insisting they will wait for a new president next year to name a new justice. Obama says the partisan divide in Congress could seep into the judiciary and make it just as bad as our politics.
And that erodes the institutional integrity of the judicial branch. At that point, people lose confidence in the ability of the courts to fairly adjudicate cases and controversies.
The president has nominated D.C. Appellate Court Justice Merrick Garland to the High Court. In the presidential races, the spotlight fell on former President Bill Clinton Thursday as he campaigned in New York for his wife Hillary. He was heckled by a group of Black Lives Matter protesters who were chanting that his crime bill in the 1990s was responsible for the number of black men in prison. An angry Clinton fought back against the hecklers, saying the bill saved a lot of lives.
I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens.
Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are locked in a key Democratic battle for delegates in the April 19 New York primary. It's a major problem. About 16% of Ohioans either have a felony or misdemeanor conviction and often face discrimination when they're looking for a home. The Department of Housing and Urban Development took a step this week to help give these individuals a second chance.
A new guidance released by HUD makes it clear that blanket bans on selling a home or renting an apartment to anyone with a criminal record is illegal discrimination and violation of the Fair Housing Act. And Rebecca Vallis with the Center for American Progress believes it should be applauded.
This measure has the potential to address housing discrimination, to help families reunify and stay together, and to save taxpayer dollars in the form of reduced incarceration costs, all while increasing public safety.
She explains that safe and stable housing is critical to successful reentry and can reduce recidivism, yet 4 out of 5 landlords use criminal background checks when vetting potential renters. Mary Sherman reporting.
The American Civil Liberties Union is among the groups that have filed an administrative complaint against the Department of Homeland Security for confiscating money and property from individuals before deporting them. The groups allege that immigration officials confiscated and failed to return personal belongings, exposing at least 26 people to greater risk of harm on their return to Mexico. Attorney Kristen Love with ACLU New Mexico says without money or ID, people face extreme hardships in Mexico.
People are deported to border cities far from where they are from without anything and have a very difficult time even paying for a place to stay when they're on the border or paying for food or getting a bus to get home.
Jillian Christensen, National Press Secretary for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, says her agency is investigating the complaints. She adds that not returning belongings, money, or identification prior to deportation is against agency policy. In Wisconsin, there is a new law regarding cell phone use while driving. Tim Morrissey reports that it's aimed at keeping construction workers safe.
If a law enforcement officer sees you talking on a handheld cell phone while driving in a construction zone, you could be pulled over and fined. Governor Scott Walker signed into law a bill that imposes a fine of $20 to $40 for drivers who get caught violating the new law. Nick Jarmusch of AAA Wisconsin says it's more important now than ever before to be fully alert while driving in construction zones.
There are people, you know, construction workers that are right there in the roadways and very vulnerable. So it's critically important that motorists are alert and watching out for them as much as possible.
Jarmusch points out that with spring here, there will be highway construction projects all over the state.
A new report released by the White House during National Public Health Week outlines what climate change has in store for human health in the United States. Drawing on research from 8 federal agencies, the report projects future impacts in western states, including illness and premature deaths, due to degraded air quality from rising temperatures, ozone, drought, and wildfires. Kirk Huber with the American Lung Association of Colorado says he hopes the report will move policymakers to act.
This is not something way off in the distant future. It's already happening. You can't turn around climate change the way you turn a car around, so it's more like an ocean liner. All things being equal, it will be an increasing part of our lives with each succeeding year.
The study paints a grim picture of a future without climate action, more severe hurricanes, heavy rains and flooding, hotter and longer heat waves. And that's the news. I'm Mark Richardson for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine's Jobs Talk. Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law a bill that will raise California's minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2022. The increase will be gradual, with the minimum wage going up from $10 an hour to $10.50 an hour next January, $11 the next year, then rising by $1 a year, after which raises would be tied to the cost of living. Small businesses would have an extra year to comply, and the governor could waive increases in bad economic times. The action claims to help struggling workers in California, which has a high cost of living and has the backing of labor unions. The impact will be substantial in communities like El Cajon, a city that has the highest poverty rate in San Diego County, as well as many recent immigrants, most from Iraq. But it adds extra costs to businesses, and that's got some small business owners and their representatives concerned. Locally, two business groups representing Iraqi Chaldean Americans have split on the issue, with one opposed and the other in support of the minimum wage hike. Ben Colasso, president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, says that while his organization supports some increase in the minimum wage, we vehemently oppose the rate of increase and the phasing methodology. The Chaldean American Chamber instead pushed for a 25-cent a year raise for 3 years, followed by a 50-cent raise for 3 years. Colasso argues that a dollar a year rise will cripple our recovering economy, adding, employers will not be able to afford the demand of the new wage increase, especially since employers are just now becoming accustomed to and in compliance with the Affordable Care Act. A dollar an hour may not sound like much, but that adds up to $40 a week for each full-time worker. By 2022, that $5 an hour raise over the next 5 years amounts to about $200 a week per employee, or more than $10,000 a year for each full-time worker. So, a small business with 5 full-time employees would see costs go up by over $50,000. A business with 10 workers would need to pay over $100,000 more in payroll costs than today. But supporters of the law have argued that businesses ultimately can benefit from the law. If consumers with higher incomes spend more money on goods and services than small and large businesses provide. The Neighborhood Market Association, which represents primarily Chaldean-owned businesses, has announced that it supports the new law raising minimum wage to $15 an hour. To us, this is not a political issue. It's an American issue. Mark Arabo, head of the Neighborhood Market Association, states in a press release, "We need to ensure that every parent who is working full-time is able to support themselves and their children. After seeing the positive impact of raised wages throughout the United States, it is becoming clear that this bump is overwhelmingly positive for small business owners and employees alike. As one of the largest small business associations, we applaud Governor Brown's decision to make a $15 minimum wage raise law." He concludes, We need to do more to protect families whose only intention is to provide for themselves and their loved ones. The $15 an hour minimum wage is a step in the right direction for working families throughout California.
At a time when many states are eroding reproductive rights for women, California just increased them. A new law that took effect the first of this month gives California women the right to obtain birth control without a doctor's prescription. The law was approved by voters via a ballot initiative. It does require that a woman visit a pharmacist and fill out a screening form to make sure that she doesn't have a medical issue that could make a doctor's visit necessary. Pharmacists can now provide birth control pills, patches, and certain other forms of birth control. There is no age limit, so the measure gives access to teenagers as well as adults. Supporters say the new law will reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies and result in a decrease in abortions by making more accessible, convenient, and affordable birth control. The president of the California Pharmacists Association, Sarah McBain, who is also a professor at the University of California, San Diego, told the Los Angeles Times, "The easier it is for someone to access medication, the more likely they are to use it." Opponents object to providing teens easier access to birth control without parental consent. Some have also voiced concerns that if women are not visiting doctors for checkups, sexually transmitted diseases might not be diagnosed. The law does not guarantee access at all pharmacies, however, since pharmacies are allowed, but not required, to dispense birth control. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is the Reverend Shane Harris, and he is the president of the National Action Network right here in San Diego. Reverend, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and it's an honor to be here.
Now, your organization was started nationally, I understand, by the Reverend Al Sharpton about, what, 25 years ago?
Yes, in 1991, Reverend Al Sharpton founded the organization. The organization was created to create a modern-day civil rights and social justice agenda that represented the history of Dr. Martin Luther King well, and it has done that for 25 years.
Very good. Now, the San Diego chapter is much more recent. When did that get started?
Yes, the San Diego chapter was beginning to get started in August of 2015. And since then, we've been very vibrant on the issues and all around the county.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. What motivated you to start this chapter?
Well, my history, my story goes back to the loss of both of my parents.
And you're from San Diego.
I am. I'm from Southeast San Diego. I grew up on Skyline Drive near Morris High School. The loss of both of my parents, the foster care system, 13 years, 8 different placements, feeling hopeless, feeling challenged, realizing what it was to be an underserved youth. I went through those challenges. And so I saw it fit to start the chapter when I was fighting the Penal Code 182.5 case here in San Diego. District attorney was going after several young African-American males, primarily African-American males in Southeast San Diego, and trying to document them as gang members based on affiliation or feeling that they were affiliated. And I said, No, that's not right. We're going to go down and we're going to speak up on this. And I did. I began to go down and fight this. Little did I know that I would follow in the vein of Reverend Al Sharpton and begin to start a chapter, the National Action Network. I looked into National Action Network and saw it fit that we would bring a chapter here. It was very important to me.
And you are getting some attention even nationally, I understand, on the presidential campaign trail with Donald Trump, one of the Republican front runners there, actually mentioning you in his discussion of the Reverend Al Sharpton's visit here. He referred to you as that activist, that 23-year-old activist that Reverend Sharpton has taken under his wing. So.
Yeah, Donald Trump, he shoots from the hip. He does nothing scripted. I don't take it offensive, you know, because that's just Donald Trump. But I felt honored to be in Donald Trump's mouth and to be viewed as this 23-year-old activist who's nonsense and who just is all over the place. and following in the footsteps of one of the great civil rights leaders. So,
well, you must be making some waves to be getting on his radar.
I guess I am, and I hope I keep making waves. That I want him to keep talking about me.
Very good. Well, let's talk about some of the specific civil rights and social justice causes that you have become involved in here locally. And I guess the thumbnail list of those would include housing fairness, criminal justice, minimum wage, and education equality. Now, your organization is based in San Diego, but I understand that you're involved in issues all over the county, from Poway to the South Bay, and also some out here in East County. Let's go through some of the different issues you're involved with, starting with criminal justice. Can you tell us what some of the things are that you're hoping to achieve right there and some of the cases that you're involved in, including one right here in East County?
Well, first of all, let me backtrack and say that the Sheriff's Department here in East County, which is and primarily in the rural areas where the Sheriff's Department resides, mm-hmm. there's been a challenge with controversial cases and things that have happened where the African-American and minority community as a whole has felt non-engaged in conversation with the Sheriff's Department. And what we're seeking to do, I met with Sheriff Gore some weeks ago, and we're mm-hmm. seeking to develop an infrastructure where minorities can voice their opinions and their challenges to the sheriff in a town hall structure. And that's what we're developing. In light of all of that, there's a case that I met with Sheriff Gore on that was not discussed much because of the confidentiality of it, but it was the Robert Branch case. It was a chokehold case that took place. This young man, Robert Branch, who's not from here, mm-hmm. lives here in East County, was driving on the 8, pulled over off of Alvarado Road, and pulled over because he was having some issues with his car, trying to get off the freeway. It looked like it was reckless driving. At that time, when he pulled over, he was on his way to work, having some issues with his car. He was going to check his car when a unmarked sheriff pulled up behind him. Now, he didn't know who this was, and
no,
so
of course not, yeah.
The sheriff gets out of the car, walks up to Robert Branch, and begins to converse with him about he's a sheriff, he is this and that and the other. And Robert asks for his identification.
Very reasonable question under the circumstances.
Now, mind you, all of this is on video. Robert Branch started recording because nationally we've seen these cases, Trayvon Martin, you know, Eric yeah. Garner, these serious cases that have taken place. And as an African-American male, he begins recording because he feels yeah. concerned.
So he had his cell phone with him and turned it on.
He had his cell phone and began to turn it on. And the sheriff was getting offended by that. But it was at the point when Robert Branch asked for his identification that he could not get this unidentified sheriff to identify himself, that the young man, Robert Branch, says to him, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything. I need your identification. We've seen these things nationally. And he tells the sheriff that what was happening with Trayvon Martin and Eric Garner and Michael Brown in Ferguson, that those same things could happen here. Robert Branch said that to the deputy.
Okay.
And when he said that to the deputy got offended and grabbed his neck and put him in an armbar chokehold. And from that point on, from the armbar chokehold, he choked him out, and it basically Robert Branch passed out. Phone drops, the screen goes black for wow. several minutes. And Robert Branch was left in the sheriff's car for 2 hours
wow.
without hospitalization.
What
because
happened
the
to him?
Sheriff was in the wrong territory. It was SDPD territory. So SDPD actually had to take him to the hospital and then put him in custody.
So what's happened with, first of all, was he injured as a result of that? Did he recover, I hope, after this incident?
He did recover, but had some respiratory challenges.
So what's happened as a result? Is there any accountability, anything that's going to happen?
Well, Dan Gillian, Attorney Dan Gillian, who's a civil rights attorney, and actually works a lot, does a lot of work with National Action Network, he got involved in the case immediately when it happened back in August of 2015, right around the time National Action Network was getting started.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Gillian got on that thing and really began to build this case from a civil rights perspective, brought in the criminal attorney, Mark Conan, who took over from there, and they have filed a lawsuit as well, and they're moving forward in this thing. Bonnie Dumanis, though, filed the investigation, and it was because the sheriff said that he was assaulting him. The sheriff said that he had a weapon.
Oh, and so, the video proved that he didn't.
Right, the video proved that he didn't. So right now we're going through the case. The prelim is taking place April 5th, at the district attorney's office downtown.
Wow. Well, keep us posted on that. We'll definitely want to keep our listeners on the radio show and our readers on our website informed about what's going on with that.
Yeah, in April 4th, the day before, we will hold a rally outside the district attorney's office, looking over 200 strong to go down there and make a statement about this injustice taking place.
Thank you for sharing that. On to housing issues. Tell us some of the major problems that you are seeing in housing in, I guess, predominantly minority or poor neighborhoods locally, and what you're doing to try to change that.
Here locally, and even on a national level, there is a great conversation happening, probably like never before, on fair housing and how fair housing must be, along with policing, along with these other issues, that this is also an injustice, like education and other issues. Mm-hmm. And so here in San Diego, there's been a big challenge to Mayor Kevin Faulkner to increase, for San Diego City, increase code compliance department of the city.
So we're not talking about, say, racial discrimination, something as blatant as somebody refusing to rent to, say, an African-American family. We're talking about substandard conditions that can actually be unhealthy in a lot of the
correct,
maybe the apartments that tend to be in the lower income neighborhoods.
Right. Molding, which causes respiratory issues, roofs caving in. This should be a concern to us all.
Sure.
And so the city, whatever city you live in, is actually, every city should have a code compliance department that focused directly on holding property owners accountable for the way that they treat tenants.
So how many code compliance officers does the city of San Diego have?
The city of San Diego had, last time we checked, about 5 code compliance officers.
5.
It was very low.
For a city of how many millions of people? That's
right.
Seems pretty low.
And that should be a concern to us all. Mm-hmm. But here in El Cajon, we challenged a case here in El Cajon where several tenants of an apartment complex lost their roof and several molding issues, respiratory, kids having respiratory asthma, all these issues. And we filed a code compliance complaint with the city of El Cajon and still have not gotten a solid response from the mayor or from the council. We went to the council, spoke up at the council meeting, still have not gotten a solid response. So these are the kind of issues that we're dealing with. And we're dealing with a political system that has not understood that fair housing is a civil right. It is a right of the people.
Very troubling. Now, isn't there a new California law that gives a little bit more strength to people that are battling mold issues if you're a tenant? Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, there is a California law. I forgot what number it's under. The code
just took effect.
Right. But it is a law that requires city departments to hold property owners accountable through that code compliance department of the city.
So what recourse do you have if a city is not doing that for whatever reason? Could there be litigation as a result of that to try to force the compliance?
Well, what a lot of these cities do is they say, well, we already have enough code compliance officers, or we don't have enough, and we are going to look at that case, but it's just going to take time. So a lot of these cities are just delaying.
So there's no time limit, basically.
There's no time limit.
Endlessly.
And this may be where we go to the governor eventually and say, you know, I see the governor once a year, and this may be where we have this conversation mm-hmm. about what is the time limit on the cities taking care of these issues.
Yeah, they need one.
Is there an accountability from the state?
Very interesting. Another big issue is minimum wage. Now, just this week, we have seen the governor sit down and hammer out an agreement with labor to basically kind of bypass the need for that $15 an hour minimum wage measure that has passed, that had qualified for the November ballot, and instead raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2022, starting at $10.50 an hour in January of next year, and then going up, I think, about $1 a year. You know, for each year thereafter. How involved have you been in that effort at either the statewide level or the local level where the city council has also been addressing minimum wage raise issues?
Well, nationally, I first say this, the National Action Network has been on the forefront of minimum wage. Labor unions, we do a lot of work with labor.
Yes, it's on the campaign trail now. The candidates are talking about that.
Right. And so in New York is where Fight for 15 actually began, the Fight for 15 conversation. Mm-hmm. Over 30,000 in the streets, and Reverend Sharpton, our national founder and president, spoke at that rally. From that level all the way until now, we've gotten very far. Here in California, the governor has issued a statement that yesterday, in which he did talk about how his plan is going to be to secure this fight for $15 minimum wage by 2022, where we will then see the raise taking place. Locally here in San Diego, we will be having a meeting with several labor unions today, a matter of fact, about what our action is going to be. We are looking to hold local leadership accountable for ensuring that this happens on a state level, but on a local level as well, that we see this raise the wage effort from council members, especially progressive council members like David Alvarez, Myrtle Cole, who have said things about these issues. So we're really, you know, going along with the state level, because this is coming from state legislator out down into the local.
Sure. I should ask, what is your response to those from the business community, especially the small business community, that have voiced concerns about this, about how can we afford this, or we may have to lay workers off or close a business if it goes to 15 an hour?
Well, my response to them would be to do whatever you have to do. But on a general level, when you're dealing with these big corporations like McDonald's and Burger King and these other corporations that are taking advantage of whether it's blacks, whites, Hispanics that are underserved in these corporations and working for these corporations, they should get paid their wage, the wage that they're worth. And so this is not really a conversation about local businesses or small businesses struggling to pay the wage. This is a conversation on a wider scale, dealing with people getting paid what they're worth. And what I would say to those businesses is use this moment to increase your business, whatever you do, so that we can bring more people into those small businesses and those small businesses can.
Yeah, there's certainly an argument that if the wages go up for everybody, that all those low wage people right now would suddenly have more money to spend and they'd be able to go out and buy more hamburgers or products at some of these businesses that are perhaps concerned. So it actually could have a plus as well as a minus for the small business owners.
Right. And it's all about marketing. And it's all about how you share your business.
Sure.
But what I will say is that minimum wage also we must realize is even if it is raised to 15, people in, especially in cities like San Diego, are still going to have a significant challenge with rent, with all these other, you know, expenses. It's not going to make a major, major difference.
Yeah, it's still 6 years out to reach that level. And I don't know what the living wage is considered to be for San Diego County.
It'll go to $10.50 this year. It'll go to $11.50. So it's going to occur over the years. And
that's minimum wage. But what's the living wage considered to be in San Diego, which is one of the most expensive places to live in the country with very high rent, high utilities, you know, a lot of transportation costs.
I was seeing some of those ratings this past weekend. I believe it was somewhere between $1,300 and $1,500 a month rent expenses that are here in San Diego County, that's the average rent.
Yeah. So how can you if you're under
$1,200?
Sure.
So to get paid, you know, $15 an hour, it's not going to make a significant difference, especially in a 6 year period, but it's going to make a difference. And that's what we're all reaching to do is continue to make a difference.
Yeah. And the other thing that's changed a lot, I think, in recent years is it used to be minimum wage. That was sort of thought of as the entry level hamburger flipping jobs for the teenagers. But now we're seeing more and more middle class people, even older folks nearing retirement age, doing this and having trouble affording, say, their medication costs. I know people who are, you know, on heart medicines and things, and it's a choice between do I pay the rent, do I get my medicine this month? So I think there's a lot of people that would be affected that some folks might be surprised to know are earning a minimum wage.
I agree.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Let's move on to education equality issues. Tell us some of the things that the National Action Network is involved in there at the national level, and then some of what you have been doing locally here.
Yeah, well, on a national level, I'll first say we've been fighting big on affirmative action. This has been a national conversation. The Fisher versus Texas University case that deals with a white girl who was surpassed by a African American at Texas University who felt as if this was a racially entitled charge by the schools to bring this individual in because they were black. And she's taken it all the way to Supreme Court. Now this case has gone all the way to Supreme Court. In the last hearing, Justice Scalia had the nerve in the last hearing to say that he felt that affirmative action is like a racial entitlement. But, you know, my thoughts on that was that it's not a racial entitlement. It's an American entitlement.
This goes to the importance, I guess, of who that next Supreme Court nominee will be to replace the late Justice Scalia, who, of course, recently passed away.
Right. And so Justice Scalia making that comment further brought into the significance that we're still battling equality on a national level and on local levels in education. That today we're still arguing about the fairness of affirmative action and if it should be taking place or not.
Let's talk about two specific cases you've been involved in here locally.
Locally,
one of them was up in the
Poway Unified School District.
District where you took on a case. I'm going to let you tell us about it. But this really drew some ire from the president of the school board up there who basically said that you were spewing nonsense, had no clarity on issues, and that you were very controversial. What's your response to those remarks?
Well, again, I'm honored anytime somebody has a, whatever they want to say about me, they're putting my, you know, our message further out. But, you know, her comments about me being controversial, you know, charged to try to, you know, do things without being educated on issues, those are statements that someone is making who is probably that themselves.
You've kind of got them on the defensive a little bit, maybe. Tell us what the issue was that prompted all of that up in Poway.
Well, the issue was that there was a man named Christopher Garnier, who's actually now a member of National Action Network. And Christopher Garnier had been dealing with several issues in the Poway Unified School District particular and brought those issues to board meetings. He would speak up at board meetings. He would get passionate at board meetings. He would say things at board meetings that the board was feeling uncomfortable, particularly the president of the school board, Michelle O'Connor Ratcliffe. And when he would speak up passionately, what has happened is that he would challenge. He would say that he's going to file lawsuits, so on and so forth. So what they did was they went back to a law firm that has been using school districts.
What's the name of that firm?
The Shinoff Law Firm. They're around all around the county. They're down in South Bay. They're in North County heavy. This law firm is using school districts, which comes down to taxpayer money for unnecessary restraining orders. And Christopher Garnier, they gave him a restraining order.
A restraining order to prevent him from speaking?
Speaking at board meetings. He could not even come to board meetings.
In a public forum.
In a public forum.
Was he offensive in some, I mean, other than saying something they disagreed in, what was
he? Was passionate, and they took that passion and said that he was being threatening. And so this has been the conversation happening.
Did he make any threats?
No. He of course threatened in the sense of he's going to file a lawsuit. He's going
Which is a legal right of anyone. Right. We've heard plenty of school board meetings where people get up and threaten lawsuits. So that's hardly
And the same law firm that is on this restraining order in Poway is the same law firm that's on this restraining order in Escondido Unified School District with the Fregoso case.
What's that about?
Jose Fregoso, same thing, except he's on the board of directors for the Escondido Unified School District.
Now, are these folks trying to appeal these restraining orders?
Basically trying to – well, yes, they both are appealing these restraining orders. With Jose Fregoso, different situation, first Hispanic ever, first minority ever on the Escondido Unified School District board. And so he's speaking up on minority issues. He's passionate.
So he's a board member. So they got a restraining member against their own board member?
The full board members got a restraining order against him.
Wow.
Took him to court for months, $70,000 he spent out of his pocket for this case. And particularly, their whole case was about him pointing fingers in their face, him being passionate about the kids so that he would come up to the school district all the time and call the superintendent, get his papers and all these things for the board meetings. They took him to court on small expressions of how they said he was being threatening. The judge ended the note this past week and said he didn't see how pointing fingers and doing these things. He says he's seen worse situations with school board meetings and school board.
Sure, so have I. I've covered many of them through the years.
Right.
And we've seen many members who are a passionate dissident voice on the school board speak out over and over and over again. And while I've seen efforts sometimes to suppress those voices in other ways, we've never seen anybody resorting to taking them to court and actually essentially muzzling, in the case in Escondido, not merely a member of the public, which is bad enough, but an elected official who's supposed to be the voice of the public speaking out.
Right. So now National Action Network in North County has spoken up, and they're building a coalition. I joined them in the press conference after the court hearing last week. And we were actually putting up a strategy against this Shinoff law firm. We are going to expose how much money the districts are paying for this law firm.
Do you know if they represent school districts in East County? I would love to know that.
That is a good question. I've heard that they do represent some school districts. I just don't know what the particulars are, but we will be going back to get that information, and we will come to the public on a countywide level on how this law firm is using these districts.
You are also involved in another incident right here in East County. This one is at the Cajon Park Elementary School, which is in the Santee Unified School District.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, there's been a woman, her name is Shelley Monroe. She's got three African-American kids that attend the Cajon Park Elementary School. And what is happening is that the parents and some of the kids are charging racial comments, slurs to her, calling the kids the N-word and calling, you know, the kids this, throwing oranges at the kids.
I'm like, well, that would be assault.
The principal has all of the complaints. The principal never reported the complaints to the school district.
Why? Do we know?
We don't know. And the school district's now looking into it since we now, along with Shelley, have filed the complaints from National Action Network.
What about the parent of the children that that were doing these things? Have they been contacted? And what was the parent's response?
Well, now the parent has been contacted because the filing that we've occurred with the district. But prior to this, their response has been it is not the principal's responsibility to talk to the school district unless they feel that it is totally necessary and so on and so forth. Santee, the point here is that Santee has a history of racially motivated incidents and has a history of the KKK. And this is a conversation that must continue to occur because now we're here and we're not going to tolerate it, National Action Network.
Yeah, we've seen incidences of that in the past. I can certainly remember quite a few in Santee through the years, not only in that school district, but at least one other school district that serves right. Santee as
what
well.
What did it for this mother was that one day she came to the school to pick her kids up and came back and had the N-word slurred across her car.
Oh, my goodness.
And when this happened, there's pictures out there, when this happened to Shelley, she then knew she was going to have to move to the next steps. Her kids are terrified to go back to school. We've been fighting this case, and the kids, the school district is actually trying to create a plan as we speak, on getting these kids back into the school. They are going to attend this school. We are not going to pull them out because we want to challenge the district to take care of these kids just like any other kid.
Well, it's good to hear that they're looking out for the kids that were persecuted, but what about the kids that were the perpetrators that were throwing things and calling racial names? What's going to happen to them? Is the school district planning any sort of discipline or maybe moving them to another school?
Good question. Currently, when I met with the president of the school board, her stance on that was that they're going to investigate the allegations and see what actions they will move forward from there. And that was before spring break, which is this past week. So we will find out today more information.
Yeah, and a good question about what are they going to do to assure the safety of these three African-American kids if they go back to the school. I understand they're the only three African-American students at the school.
Yeah, there's one other parent who has African-American at the school, and that's it. The school's primarily white.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wouldn't be surprised. I mean, this is Santee. But no matter how many African-American or minorities are at a school, they should be treated as equally as every other child on that campus.
Absolutely. It's the law and the decent thing to do.
This definitely should be a conversation since African-American and minorities are moving to East County.
It should. And
they
should
begin to develop this conversation anyway.
I would add that East County Magazine is very interested in hearing from any other families out there who may have had other incidents that perhaps were not reported or reported and nothing was done about them. So if that has happened to you or your child, you can certainly reach out to us at editor@eastcountymagazine.org with your story. Let's move on to the presidential campaign race. Now, I understand that, again, you're being recognized all over the country here, not only by Donald Trump, but by the Democrats in this race as a mover and shaker in the San Diego area, and that both the presidential candidates are courting you for a possible endorsement. You had a meeting just recently with Senator Bernie Sanders when he was in town on the campaign trail. How did that go?
I did. I met with Senator Sanders. He wanted to meet with me on his stop here in San Diego. He found it important because he felt I was an important person in this region. I felt honored. Mm-hmm. The meeting went very well. I met with him in the holding room prior to him heading out to see the over 13,000 that attended the rally. I mean, it was significantly packed.
Yeah, and we were there, by the way, covering that rally. Listeners can
were there.
Find our coverage and some highlights.
Yeah, and there was over 13,000 outside the whole day waiting for to see this man on stage.
Huge.
It was an honor to meet with him behind closed doors, and we talked about various issues around affirmative action, around mass incarceration, around criminal justice reform. He answered bluntly about the local citizens review board issue concerning a more independent review board. He said, you can't have a review board.
Yeah, let's go back because I don't think we talked about that on the air yet. We talked a little bit about the sheriff issues, but not the San Diego police. And you have spoken out and said the San Diego Police Department needs an independent citizens review board.
Yeah, we are calling for an independent citizens review board for police practices. It is unfortunate and unnecessary to have a review board reviewing police practices that works for the city of San Diego. You cannot have a review board reviewing the very
conflict of interest, basically.
Right. It's a conflict of interest. And so we've been calling for that. Bernie Sanders used his muscle also in the Fight for 15 pledge, and he got up and spoke vigorously on that.
He did in San Diego. He spoke out on that.
So Senator Sanders, I have not, of course, decided to make an endorsement yet until after my meeting with with former Secretary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But when we would discuss in the next few weeks about where I'm looking to go, as far as presidential candidates, is very important. San Diego is the 8th largest city in the United States of America. We should be considered here, and we are important here. And that is what I wanted to ensure in meeting with Senator Sanders.
We are important. And I understand Senator Sanders is going to be meeting with you at least one more time between now and the primary. Is that correct?
Yes. We are bringing Senator Sanders back for a meeting with myself and several community leaders here in the San Diego region. And we will discuss with him several issues. The Chaldeans are going to bring their issues. The Hispanics, they're going to bring their issues. The Blacks are going to bring their issues to this meeting.
The Native Americans?
Yes, as well. 40 influential leaders from this region will gather to meet Senator Sanders. And it will be on issues around voting rights, around policing, around mass incarceration, mm-hmm. around issues in their communities that they're going to bring.
Are you looking into voting rights issues in San Diego County? And I will add just as an aside that we had a complaint from a reader yesterday that said, how come there's no polling place for Campo this year? And made me wonder how many others are missing. So I've put a records request into the registrar to see how the polling places and number of voting machines here compare with what they had in, say, the 2008 or 2012 primaries. But have you looked at that at all?
Well, yes. We're putting together actually a strong campaign called the Rock the Vote campaign. We're bringing it back. It was a historically great campaign.
I remember.
And we want to enhance it, do a little something different here in the county. Rock the Vote is going to push to bring people not just to participate in voting this year, but to be educated on who's on the ballot. We'll hold several forums mm-hmm. and discussions on who's on the ballot and just let people openly talk about the judges that are on the ballot. The people that we don't realize, we know the presidential candidates, we know the mayoral candidates, but we don't know the judges and the city attorney and all these other people that are important players in the political atmosphere. So we're going to have these discussions. Part of is to put pressure on the county board, registrar, because there is a concern, particularly for college students.
Yeah, around the country, we've seen places where they maybe have one polling place or none at all on a major college campus.
Yeah. I'm also going to push, even though I know it's probably too late, going to push the county register to look at a Sundays to the Polls campaign.
Ah.
There was once that campaign, Souls to the Polls, which took place on Sundays, where people would get out of church and go vote. That needs to be here as well. It's very important.
Yeah, a lot of people work on Tuesdays, and certainly we don't want what we saw in Arizona, which is people standing in line for 5 or 6 hours. And if you've got to be at work, you can't do that.
And Arizona's broken out some concerns of some misconduct with the voting there.
That goes to the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act. What happened in Arizona, I understand, would not have been legal if the Supreme Court hadn't tossed out much of the Voting Rights Act, because Arizona did have a history of discriminatory voting practices and in the past would not have been allowed to make changes to its procedures without federal approval.
Yeah, there's a history of that in Arizona, and it's much like Santee.
Yeah. Well, speaking of presidential candidates, I would certainly be remiss if I didn't give you the opportunity to give us your impressions or concerns, as it would be, regarding not only we talked about the Democrats, but what about the Republicans in this race, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz?
Oh, goodness. Donald Trump is a 21st century knockoff of Ronald Reagan. This is historically, we've gone to get presidential candidates nationally. This happened with Ronald Reagan. He was an entertainer. I think.
Yeah, like Schwarzenegger maybe for governor,
right,
or.
For governor, right. So this is historically and systemic. They went to get an entertainer because they didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, he was known as a billionaire, but he was also a celebrity on reality TV with his.
This is almost a reality TV presidential race. And Donald Trump has turned it into quite an interesting race because he's divided the Republican Party.
But more so, I think, than any Republican or any candidate that we've seen in modern times, certainly in the last several decades, he's been pretty overt about some of his racially charged messaging and also refusing to distance himself from even David Duke, the head of the KKK, who endorsed him, and he couldn't seem to come up with the words, you know, for a long time to distance himself from that. We've seen Black Lives Matter protesters, you know, roughed up at his rallies and so forth.
They stopped him from coming into Chicago.
Well, are you concerned that if he were somehow to get the nomination or go on to the presidency, that we might see a rolling back of some of the, you know, civil rights protections or an increase perhaps in hate speech and what can come from that?
I agree. I totally agree. I might move the country. but if Donald Trump gets the nomination, I don't think Donald Trump cares to be president. I think he's just creating a stir up here. I think that he's sort of causing a rift and a division in the Republican Party.
He is.
And it's a good thing from that center and that perspective. I think that he has nothing on neither one of the Democratic candidates for president. Hillary and Bernie can both outsmart him. They have bigger crowds, and they just have a greater effect. As far as Donald Trump, the only thing I will say, and I think Senator Sanders has also made this commentary as well, that Donald Trump, the only reason why he's able to wire off and say all the things he's saying is because Donald Trump is running his own campaign. And that's a reality. This man has taken his own money and funded his own campaign. And that's what we must realize. That's how crucial and serious this is. Mm-hmm. What a man can do when a man runs his own campaign with his own money. And when you start taking money from several different people, you begin to lose your clout and your ability to lead. And I'm not saying that Donald Trump has the ability to lead, mm-hmm. but it happened to Tony Young here locally. When Tony Young, taking money from the Lincoln Financial and all these other folks, he was a progressive Democrat who began to get into other money. That same thing, Donald Trump is, you know, not having as many issues because he has not taken money from anybody particular to run his campaign. He's running his campaign off of his own money. So he's wiring off and saying all kinds of things. Do I think he's going to become president? No, I don't think he'll get it at all. He's doing nothing but making it better for Democrats across this nation.
Well, there you go. And maybe even having the Republican Party look a little bit into its heart and its soul just what has fueled the rise of a Donald Trump within their own party.
Right. Yeah. He's definitely shaking them up. But, you know, Donald Trump, I'll say this. I want to wire back real quick here. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is saying things that conservative Republicans have been wanting to say. He's saying things. He's not shading anything over. This is what white supremacists historically wanted somebody to say from the Republican Party. And he's saying those things. That's why these people are coming out to the rallies.
So you're saying he's really just more overt about what the Republican Party has really been doing all
Correct.
Along. They may say, hey, we got a, you know, a black candidate with Ben Carson or whatever.
Right.
Or a Latino candidate with Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. But
right.
really, if you look at their policies, it's been anti-immigration. It's been,
right.
you know, anti-Latino.
And Ted Cruz,
it's been,
Ted Cruz is doing something that I call bringing back the slavery of the Bible. You know, Ted Cruz is a, you know, white supremacist in my perspective, who is someone who is trying to use the Bible to carry his own weight. But if you look at historically, look at the Bible was also used to enslave blacks and enslave minorities. And so you've got to know the history of the tool you're using. And that is what Ted Cruz is running around using. He's running around using his Bible rhetoric and his personality being a Christian.
Yeah. We've also seen the party largely trying to dismantle a lot of the social programs that, while they may help some whites, tends to predominantly help minorities, as well as things like affirmative action that so many of them are opposed to. So yeah. I think you're onto something when you say that Donald Trump is really just saying what a lot of the people supporting
Donald
the Republican
Trump is
Party
saying
are.
What white supremacist Republicans have been wanting to say for a long time, and he's free enough to say it, but dangerous enough if we don't vote. We've got to vote, and we've got to ensure that Bernie or Hillary secure this vote, whoever becomes the nominee.
Listeners, if you just turned in, we are speaking with the Reverend Shane Harris with the National Action Network team. That's the organization founded by the Reverend Al Sharpton nationally. Reverend Shane is the local president of that. If people want to get more information about your organization, where can they find it?
They can go to www.nansd.net. Again, www.nansd.net is where they can get more information, or they can call us at 619-431-3186.
And that's the National Action Network, which is a nonprofit 501c4.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Okay, I'm going to let you have the final word today, Reverend Harris. What else would you like our listeners to know that I have not specifically asked you about today?
We want you to know to go out and vote this year. We want you to know to get involved in the movement. The movement is bigger than any one of us. It's about the people. And here in San Diego, we are bringing the people back to the forefront. And the conversation that the people have been, we're doing exactly what Donald Trump is doing on the progressive side. We are bringing the people back to the forefront and saying what the people have wanted to say in San Diego for so long and across this nation. We've done it for 25 years, and we're going to continue to do it the next 25 years and years after that.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you for having me.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. There's a new medical helicopter now serving East County. The Viejas Fire Department and California Reach will be holding a ribbon-cutting ceremony on Friday, April 8th, to unveil the new helicopter based at the Viejas Reservation in Alpine. The new helicopter will serve communities across rural East County. Reach now has 5 medically equipped helicopters and 1 airplane in Southern California to transport patients to needed care. Reach was named Program of the Year by the Association of Air Medical Services for exceeding industry standards for patient care and safety. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Liz Alper with a sports report for East County Magazine on KNSJ. With the San Jose Barracudas overtime loss to the San Antonio Rampage on Wednesday night, the San Diego Gulls are the 2nd team in the American Hockey League's Pacific Division to clinch a berth in the Calder Cup playoffs. The Gulls join the Ontario Reign, who are the only other Pacific team to have already clinched a playoff spot. The season ends next Sunday. Other AHL teams that have already clinched are the Milwaukee Admirals, Grand Rapids Griffins, and the Lake Erie Monsters, all from the Central Division. From the North Division, the Toronto Marlies and Albany Devils have clinched, and from the Atlantic, the Hershey Bears are the only team to have clinched.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.